guilty undertaker sighs. The lonesome organ grinder cries. The silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn. But it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you. I want you. I want you. I want you so bad. Honey, I want you. The drunken politician leaps upon the street where mothers weep, and the saviors who are fast asleep, they wait for you.
Okay, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 Accra, The Wave Farm. This is Radio for Open Ears. This is the latest installment of my show. It's called Reading is Funkdimental. It's a show all about books about music. I talk to the authors of books about music. Sometimes they're musicians themselves. I'm a musician myself. I play in a couple of bands, Spaghetti Eastern Music, Space Heater, and I write about music for various publications, including New York Times and Pop Matters and Inside Out Upstate New York. But today we're going to be talking all about Bob Dylan. With a guy named Dick Weissman, who authored a new book called Bob Dylan's New York. It's a guidebook and history of New York's key role in Dylan's lengthy career, mainly the early part of his career, which Dick witnessed because he was a Greenwich Village cat. He was in a band called The Journeymen with John Phillips, who would go on to form the Mamas and Papas, and Scott McKenzie, you know, where go to San Francisco and wear flowers in your hair. It's a great book. He's a really interesting guy. Worked as an educator after his time in music. So without further ado, let's just get on with the show and talk to Dick Weissman about Bob Dylan. Okay, here we are with Mr. Dick Weissman, who wrote this fabulous book. If you want to walk in the footsteps of Bobby D, this is the ultimate thing to get. Before we get into it, I just want to share with you, I don't know if I had shared, I think I did in the review, that I actually had a rock and roll bus tour company with a guy named Danny Fields, who managed the Ramones and Iggy Pop.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm familiar with some of these places and some of these stories, and that was a kind of a fun and somewhat torturous experience, because it started as a PR event, and then Danny got approached by the Hard Rock Cafe to run it as a business, and we did for 2 summers. So I worked my day job Monday through Friday, and then on Saturdays and Sundays we did 2 tours a day, driving people around in a bus who wanted to break into Electric Lady. They're like, what, these French people, they're like, wait, we're not going inside. No, I said, we're just going to point it and tell stories. So but this is great. So let's before we get into this, let's talk about your background, you know, or that as it relates to this book, and then what have you been doing since the 60s?
Sure. I am from Philadelphia originally, mm-hmm. and I came to New York to go to graduate school at Columbia in sociology, great. Which I did. And around that time, I became friendly with Israel Young in the Folklore Center. Mm-hmm. And I played the earliest incarnation of Folk City when he and Tom Prendergast were running it. Mm. They were kind of, they had this screwy deal with Mike Porgo where I think they were getting no share of the bar, mm-hmm. and he was getting a share of the cover charge, which I think was like $2 or something. Hmm. Eventually, he kind of eased them out of it because he realized that they were onto a good thing. And basically, he figured out that getting the folk talent in the village might have been a little of a nuisance, but it wasn't hard to do. Mm-hmm. So they were gone. And so I was playing all these places on McDougal Street, you know, the basket houses and all that, the sure. Commons. And that was just before Dylan got to New York. And somewhere in there, I quit graduate school. I did all the credits, but I never wrote a thesis.
So that was the late, so you're talking about the late 50s, 1960, right around there?
It was around 57.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. So you were a musician in the scene, you know, but like you say, slightly on the scene before Bob even got there.
Yeah, I guess I didn't know I was a musician. You know, it wasn't part of my plan,
Right.
especially.
Well,
But I didn't like graduate school very much. And the opportunities just were sort of there. And I was Kenny Goldstein, who was a record producer, and he was putting out a lot of records for Riverside, the jazz label.
Sure.
He started a folk affiliate. So I got to play on maybe three or four of their albums. And it was at that point that I began to realize, oh, you actually might be able to make a living doing this.
Yeah.
And then I started teaching out of my house, and I was teaching at a little music school called the Metropolitan School of Music on the Upper West Side. So that's how it all began. And this is all just before Dylan got to New York.
Now, let's talk about before Dylan got to New York and before there was even folk. That scene was, what was the transformation between sort of the beatniks? And I guess these same clubs were very popular with poets and also, you know, comedians, as we know. The
right, particularly the Gaslight was one of those.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the Gaslight was right across the street from the Commons. So I never played the Gaslight, but I would occasionally go there. And I knew Len Chandler, who was one of the early guys, actually started out as a poet there.
He was African-American, right?
Yes, and he had a master's degree in oboe, which was a little bit strange for the folk revival even now. But in 1957, it was sort of otherworldly. So he was a friend of mine. And then once Dylan got started, all these other people appeared. Tom Paxton and Eric Anderson and so on and so forth. And Paul Stuckey of Peter, Paul and Mary.
Right.
Actually, Noel Stuckey is his real name. But that's another story.
Now, the Commons, your book, just for people to realize, it kind of breaks down. The chapters really speak about sort of specific streets. So you kind of start with McDougal. And you were talking about the Commons.
Yeah.
Which isn't, you know, it's kind of not as famous, I guess, as Gertie's Folk City or whatever. But it was kind of interesting reading about, you know, I wonder what you felt when you saw The Sopranos and you saw Dominic Chianese, Uncle June, sang there, correct? He was one of the singers.
He sang at the Commons.
And Tiny Tim.
He sang opera and sort of operetta.
Right.
And there was a guy who played flamenco guitar there. It was kind of a mixed bag. It wasn't a straight folk club. But the manager was an interesting guy who you never hear much about, Luke Askew. And Luke was an actor who later was in quite a few Hollywood movies. And he was from Georgia, white guy from Georgia. And he looked like a redneck. So that's what he ended up playing in Hollywood. But he was a good guy. And he was also occasionally playing himself at the Gaslight.
Right.
So that was part of that, so to speak, intermarriage.
So what made you decide to do the book? How did the book itself come about?
Richard Carlin, who's the editor, is a friend of mine, and it was actually his idea. And he knew that I had been in New York when Dylan got to New York, and that I also knew Dylan, although not well.
Right.
But I certainly did know him, yeah.
So he asked you to come up with this book, and it sort of...
Exactly, and I've written a number of books, so he, I guess, was confident that I would actually write it.
So let's talk about McDougal Street. Let's talk about some of the you know, talk a little bit more about some of the famous places there. Obviously, the Gaslight was on McDougal.
Yeah, Sly was across the street from the Commons, and so was the Folklore Center.
Yeah.
Folklore Center was 110.
I played that for the former location in the 80s. It became a bar called the Scrap Bar. And it had the weirdest PA. It was a heavy metal hangout, like Guns N' Roses. And because of the sound, they created their own unusual PA, which was like a gazillion little, like 3-inch speakers that were all around the club. And it was an electronic drum set, too. And you kind of plugged into the wall, no amps. It was a very dismal experience, but it did live on, as we say. So that was a very big hangout too, correct? That was the real.
And there was a bar there right next to the guest lot called the Kettle of Fish.
Right.
And I did not particularly hang out there, but Dylan did, and a number of other people, another musician named Barry Kornfeld, who is a friend of mine, who ended up as producing records for Columbia for a while.
Right. And then, so there you had also the Cafe Wa, which has a connection. A lot of people know this, but to obviously Jimi Hendrix and a lot of other people, but it also does have a David Lee Roth connection, if you can go into it.
Yeah, and Freddie Neil. I think Freddie Neil was playing there when Dylan got to New York, and Dylan was playing, I think, off hours, and he was playing. It was open some ridiculous, like 12 hours or something. Mm-hmm. So sort of wall-to-wall music there. And Dylan was, I think, originally a day player there. Mm-hmm. You know, that he was not known, and and Freddie was the night act, you know.
Right. And then also the Reggio was there, the Cafe Reggio, not necessarily a music place, but I'm sure it energized.
Actually, the Reggio, I like the Reggio. I like cannolis. So I used to go there. And
wonderful.
And,
still is.
Yeah. And I very rarely ran into any musicians there. I'm not sure why. I mean, we were neither welcomed nor were we kicked out.
Right.
You know what I mean? We were like another species from the tourists, and then the Italians who actually lived in the village.
Right. And owned a bunch of the clubs too, right? They were behind a lot of the clubs there, the town.
I don't know that. It's quite possible.
And Mike, what's his name? Mike, the guy, Porco?
Yeah, the Folk City guy, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, set the stage for Dylan's arrival in New York. When did he arrive? Where did he sleep before, I know Dave Van Ronk was a supporter.
I really only got to know him when he got involved with Dave and Dave's wife, Terry Thall.
Right.
Briefly managed Dylan and several other people as well, including Dave. And I didn't hang out at the Cafe Wa. In fact, I can't remember ever going there. The lead guy there at the time, the big act, was a steel drum player. And it just didn't particularly interest me, but it drew a lot of people.
Right.
And it was at that time when the village was, how can I put it, racially peculiar, like the first, so to speak, black tourists were coming to the village. And the Italians who lived there were fairly traditional, and they did not really welcome these visitors very much. And there was a certain amount of tension. And then some of the black musicians and so on started going out with white chicks. And that was not cool to the local residents. They thought,
there's a whole movie,
my territory, they're my women, you know.
There's a whole Spike Lee movie about that. So Dylan arrives. I mean, what were your, for, you know, personally, I mean, you're somebody who was there when he arrived. So what were your impressions? Did you think, oh my God, this guy is going to be the biggest thing? Or was it just like, oh, here's some guy from Minnesota who thinks he's Woody Guthrie and, you know.
My initial reaction, I think, and Eric Weisberg, who is a very good friend of mine, I think we had the same reaction, was, when is this guy going to learn how to sing?
Right.
You know, and he was not doing his own songs initially,
right,
to speak of.
Even on the
you
first
know, he
album.
Had on his first album, there are a couple of them, but
yeah,
he did like 8 or 10 folk songs in
right.
his arrangements. And he kind of banged on the guitar, and you know, and I was an instrumentalist. I never really was much of a singer. So when I saw somebody who banged on the guitar, I didn't find it particularly great or interesting.
Right.
And there was something of an aura pretty quickly around him.
Right.
You know, like, I guess he was sort of oddly charismatic, and the I'm an orphan routine, you know,
right.
his
He had a whole,
mythological life
yeah, whole
story.
fake, a whole fake. Now it's that sort of standard now, but in those days it was, well, what happened is, we can, I guess we can just jump to Gertie's Folk City the night of April 11th, 1961. What happens? He's there opening for somebody, and that was.
Well, for one of the big things, and I think it's less known now than it was some years ago, Bob Shelton, the critic for the New York Times, kind of fell in love with Dylan.
Right.
And started writing about him like he was the apocalypse. And New York Times, you know, Shelton was fairly new at the Times in those days, at least as a folk writer. And so I think, you know, the Times wasn't writing about the rest of us. So, you know, we had to pay attention to it, whether we liked it or not.
Right.
And suddenly Al Grossman enters the picture. Now, Al Grossman at that time in the Village, he was known for being Odetta's manager.
Right.
And Odetta, you know, had her own thing going, where I still remember, you know, you might be, say, walking down McDougal Street or 8th Street on a Saturday at 1, and you suddenly realize there's this fairly tall African-looking woman dressed in African print clothes, and there are dozens and dozens of people following her.
Wow.
As though, you know, John F. Kennedy appeared or something, you know. It was very strange. She had this effect on people. I don't think anybody ever had that effect. You know, not even Dylan. I mean, Dylan had incredible fanatic fans.
Right.
But I think at least not until he had his hit records. Maybe five people would say, that's Bobby Dylan, and they might follow him, you know. But you wouldn't see 50 people just standing in line waiting for this woman to say something magical that they could bring home with them, you know.
Now, do you think it flipped when he started to do his original songs? I mean, what was the impact of those songs to the community of musicians? I'm not talking about critics or fans, you know, this is before, when he started introducing these songs that he actually, you know, you tell in the book, you know, he lived at certain places when he started certain songs and things. I mean, were the song, did the songs have an, in, what I'm kind of getting at is there's a shift here. He's being taken seriously. And among the musicians, was it the songs, or what was the impact when he started doing original songs?
I think number one, it was the songs. Number two was the fact he had a Columbia Records contract. You
right.
know, there were a lot of us that were recording, but we were recording for, you know, Riverside or
Vanguard,
Prestige or,
yeah,
you know, whatever, not labels that that you would see at every record store in the United States.
Right.
So it was clear that something was going on here.
So
I think some people were jealous. Some people were amused. Some people just bought in. They said, hey, these are great songs. You know, like, And I'll give you an example of how this worked. It's not New York, but I was at the Newport Folk Festival the year before he turned electric.
Right, 64.
And I was sitting in the audience, and they hadn't sold that many tickets. So they gave away a lot of tickets to people in the Navy, you know, at the Newport Naval Base.
Yeah.
So this guy's sitting a row in front of me, and Dylan comes on. And he starts making, you know, really kind of ugly remarks like, what is this crap? You know, that's the worst singer I ever heard. And the guy next to him, who was also in the Navy, said, that's the guy who wrote that song that Peter, Paul, and Mary did. And the first guy immediately shut up and started to listen.
Right.
So I think that's a lot of what happened is
And
once.
that was Albert, obviously. I mean, that was all
It was
Albert.
Albert and Peter Yarrow, I think, talked
Yeah.
about a very talkative guy in general.
Yeah.
And he, I think, really did a lot to promote Dylan without, I think he just did it because he wanted to do it, you know.
Yeah. Well, when we get to the Woodstock section that we could talk a little bit more about that because the way I understand it, he was very much the guy who brought Dylan up here. And
He
then
was. He had a cabin
they had the
before
cabin.
anybody lived there, before Grossman was there.
Yeah. And then Grossman, I understand, stayed at who's the guy? God, Milton Glaser. He
Yeah,
was a
the
buddy of
artist.
Milton.
Yeah.
He was a buddy of Milton Glaser, and I think Glaser brought Albert up here. And then he saw Glaser's house and he said, gee, this is nice. I should get a nice house up here. And then everybody came up here, and it's still, I was telling you, I'm a quarter of a mile from Big Pink. I'm in West Saugerties, so I'm 5 minutes, 7 minutes from town there. But so that's the thing. It really, like you say, it was really. Once getting known for these songs more as a songwriter, which I guess kind of tempered down the criticisms of his vocal and his performance,
Oh,
like,
absolutely. It
yeah.
was people became very curious about him. And I think all that mythological stuff that he invented fed into it in an interesting way that, you know, like most people that lived in New York were not, especially in the folk scene, they more or less came from middle class backgrounds,
Right.
not entirely, but more or less. So here's this guy's kind of scruffy. He says he's an orphan. He's clearly not from New York. Never
Right.
claimed all the things that he never claimed he was from New York, which I think was actually very smart.
Right.
So there was an element of exoticism about him. Even his name, it's not really his name. And people started to be aware of all that, you know, that people were talking about him. And it just started to feed into this monster that
Well, it's speaking of monsters, this is just an observation. It's not covered in your book, but when did, sort of amphetamines, if you know, enter his orbit? Because a lot of his writing, it's kind of like he'd just sit there, the legend here, he'd sit there with the typewriter and just type for hours. And, I think the amphetamines, I'm not preaching anybody do it. But it does seem it was very connected to so much productivity in the 60s, the Warhol scene, the Beatles, when you see the Beatles jumping around on stage,
Well, supposedly he turned the Beatles on, that
Yeah.
they had never smoked pot before until he.
Delmonico, right?
So I don't know about the amphetamine
Yeah.
stuff very much because number one, I wasn't personally close to Dylan
Right.
and less so to his non-musical associates. You know, like people started to connect with him who
Right.
had nothing to do with the folk scene.
Right.
And between messing around with school and playing music, I didn't have too many connections that
Right.
were not in either one of those scenes. And the graduate school sociology thing it made the whole folk scene seem like Satanville, I mean, it was extremely straight and stratified, and I'm sure there were people doing stuff, but they sure weren't talking about it.
No, I was just curious. And then he so he lived he had several his a couple of famous locations that he lived there, if you could kind of go into, maybe a couple of those where he resided before and after Woodstock. Obviously he returned after Woodstock too
There were, he lived, I think, for a while. I think he actually lived above the Gaslight. I mean, that was an apartment building. And I don't know who else was living there, but I suspect that John Mitchell, the owner manager of the Woodstock, who was a whole story of his own, which I'm not that familiar with. That he probably had something to do with it. And then he lived at the Earl Hotel, and that's the whole thing with Joan Baez that that she wrote and sang about.
And then you also cover, speaking of hotels, you cover the Albert Hotel, which was the famous kind of rock and roll hotel there.
Yeah, the Loving Spoonful were there, and we stayed there, the band I was in, which was not a rock band, the Journeymen, but John Phillips obviously went on to the Mamas and Papas. And I think in those days he probably gravitated more to the Earl than the Albert. But those were the two places where people stayed who weren't leasing apartments.
Now, you also talk about Washington Square Park as a sort of a focal point for the gathering of musicians, and then there was also this riot when they kind of tried to shut down the Sunday jams. If you could go a little bit into that.
Washington Square Park had been a Sunday afternoon tradition for some years. And the mayor decided that it was bringing a lot of undesirables to the village, whatever that means. So that's when he got the police department to sort of enforce clearing the park out. And I think they didn't, there was a permit that allowed us to play, I think loosely from 2 to 6 or 1 to 5. And that wasn't, I mean, nobody, the bell didn't ring and the cops arrived. I mean, it was pretty loose. You could continue to play there for a little while, but people sort of planned the afternoon would go there. And then a lot of them would go to the American Youth Hostel, which had a jam session that was run where anybody could play pretty much and did. And then there was an apartment building, 190 Spring Street, and they had regular jam sessions. They were very pure and non-pop. So, that wasn't a place for Dylan especially, or even for songwriters. That was the people still singing English ballads and doing traditional pre-bluegrass instrumentals and maybe a little bit of Irish music. And there were different rooms. And if you go in the room, this is the English ballad room, and nobody is going to sing anything but an English ballad, or they will, virtually be kicked out of there, and treated with great scorn. So there was all of that stuff going on. Anyway, this is not in the book, but I had just joined the Journeymen when the Washington Square riots took place. And
That was the band
Mark
with John.
Phillips and Scott McKenzie, who had one hit wonder thing, San Francisco. Yeah. Anyway, our managers found out about the Washington Square thing, and they were freaked out because they were sure that I was going to be part of the riots and I would be in jail. And they weren't sure. Actually, that probably would have been great publicity.
Yeah, definitely.
But I didn't go to that because by that time, I was taking a lot of crap for being in a commercial band. That was not considered to be cool. And so I still had a lot of friends from there, but I was only hanging out in the village to a limited extent at that point. And I lived uptown. I lived not too far from Columbia on 106th Street. So I wouldn't, I needed to go to the village. I wasn't automatically out my front door, and I'm not, like Dylan was on me, goes out his front door, he's on McDougal Street.
Or John Sebastian, right? He lived
Yeah,
right there.
whose family was from there.
Right on the
I mean,
right
he
on
and
the
Maria Muldaur
right.
were probably the only two people that, and Dick Rosmini, the guitar player, they were all people whose families actually lived in the village.
So let's go into your own experience with the Journeyman. I wasn't quite it didn't come too much through in the book. So let me tell me about that. What was that experience like working with John and the period you were together, John and Scott?
Well, when I started, I was sort of an ultra purist. And the only way that I wasn't was that I started writing original music very early. But initially, it was mostly instrument. It was maybe four instrumentals for every vocal. And because that was basically my skill set, is that I was an instrumentalist. And also because that's what I liked. So, John got my number from Izzy Young at the Folklore Center. And I went down and met with him. And he was in a band called the Smoothies, which was it was a vocal group, kind of like the Four Lads. And that's what he was interested in. He was a hero worshiper of the Four Freshmen and those kind of vocal groups that use modern harmony. So they had made a few records for Decca. And initially, I played on a session with them, and I brought in Eric Weisberg because I was going to play banjo. We needed somebody to play guitar and mandolin. And Eric was a friend of mine. And one of the studio guys, who was not a folkie, referred to that as the first folk session in New York, the first pop folk. It was a mixture of people like Don Arnone, who probably played on 3,000 records. And, Eric and I, who were, people would look at us and we didn't wear ties, which, all studio guys in New York wore ties. That's what they did. With the single exception of Barry Galbraith, who was such a great guitarist, was sort of like, hey, if you don't want to hire me, that's fine. I'll work for Al instead of you. But everybody wore suits and ties, and nobody ever cursed, except maybe at the break. You tell stories to people because they all had a million stories about all the crazy people that were making records. Anyway, so we did that record. It came out. One of the things we did, oddly, was Michael Row the Boat Ashore, which went nowhere in our version. And so shortly thereafter, Phillips and I started hanging out a bit. And he said, what would you think if we put a folk thing together? He said, I've listened to the Kingston Trio and I know we could do something better than that musically, which I think we did. But of course, that makes no difference. I mean, nobody bought the Supreme record because they were beautiful singers. Nobody bought a lot of records. I mean, there were people who were popular who were great musicians. There were people who were popular who didn't know a C from a G sharp. I mean, it was quite a mixture of people. And I think a lot of my associates to this day get that wrong. Like, becoming a star does not imply that you are a good or a bad musician. It's almost irrelevant. You know what I mean? It's like the magnetism and the production work on the record
Even
and
more
the
so these
promotion.
days.
Yeah, I mean, it's still true. There are people that are out there that are
so how long were you guys together? How long was that?
3.5 years.
Wow.
And Scott and I quit 61-4.
And then when did Michelle?
John had a, we still had bookings. So right. John kept it alive with the new journeyman,
which was
initially included Michelle Phillips,
right,
and Marshall Brickman. And
right.
somewhere in there, Marshall Brickman dropped out and went right. into comedy.
Went to Woody.
Yeah. Yeah. And the theatrical stuff. And Denny Doherty joined up.
Wow.
So they filled whatever gigs that were left. And the pop folk thing was dying and folk rock started. And John realized that.
And speaking of that whole scenario reminds me of the movie Inside Llewellyn Davis. Have you seen
it? Yes.
How accurate is that? Did you did you enjoy it, or did it seem to be a
no? Okay. No, I didn't, because the thing I like best, I think, some of the cinematography really captured. You know, I rode the subway all the time,
right?
So it reminded me of coming down from 106th Street to the Village, mm-hmm. or coming back, you know, at 3 a.m.
right
after gigs or whatever, and. So that was all good, but
where did they make it? In Toronto? Obviously they spent so much on it, and you're like, well, why didn't they just shoot it on McDougal Street? You know what I mean? It was like, I don't know. I'm not.
Well, also, I mean, in the more recent Dylan movie,
right?
The guy that played Dylan, mm-hmm. I thought he did a good job of representing Dylan as a mm-hmm. person.
Oh, okay, good.
Less good a job as a singer, but
right, yeah.
You know, he's an actor. I mean, right. He was good enough, I think. Yeah. But you know, he did remind me of what Dylan was like in the, say, 1961.
So what happened when? So what was the impetus for Dylan? And we'll talk about, you do a section on Woodstock, a chapter on the sites in Woodstock.
Yeah.
So when was the when did that, how did that all transpire? It just got to be too much for him?
I think it got to be too much for him, and also he got married.
Right.
And I think he realized that if he was going to have a family and have anything of a private life, it just was not going to happen around McDougal Street. Now, you could say, okay, well, why didn't he move to Gramercy Park? Mm-hmm. Why didn't he move to the, you know, Upper West Side or whatever? But I think he felt that he needed to change the whole thing. And also, suddenly, all these people that were associated with him mm-hmm. started moving up there, like John Sebastian.
Right.
And Artie and Happy Trown, both of whom were good friends.
Right, right. There's,
and, you know, lots of other people, the Jeff Muldaur, Maria Muldaur, and of course Grossman.
Right.
And he and Grossman, I think, were pretty close initially.
Right.
Before Dylan realized that maybe
the publishing,
he was giving up a little bit too much monetarily. Well,
I think I mention this to you that, you know, the Bearsville complex has been redone.
Yeah, the big thing.
Yeah, it's a big thing now. She spent a lot of money. I think she sold a baby food company or something. She's a British woman, and she invested a ton of money. But he's back there. He's buried behind the. He's buried out there in the Bearsville complex,
yeah.
Albert. And then actually, she also owns. She bought what used to be the Cafe Espresso, which was the. Prior to that, it was the International Center for. Most recently, it was the Tinker Street. Tavern, I think, in the 80s, and that was a big place. But they're, you know, they have an art gallery upstairs now where he purportedly wrote a lot of his songs and hung
yeah.
out.
Yeah, I remember that.
Now did you have, what about you? When did you kind of morph out of the music biz and maybe depart the Village? What was your story?
Well, I had done the journeyman thing for 3 years.
Right.
And I realized that we had gone as far as we were going to go. Mm-hmm. The folk rock things just was starting to come in. And also, frankly, and I'm sure you've gotten this from a million people, is going on the road with people for 3 years, even if you like them, after a while, you kind of get sick of each other.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, everything that this person's going to say, everything that they're going to do, all their pickup lines, you know, things that they think are funny. And maybe they were funny 3 years ago. Now they're not funny anymore. And also, I had met somebody and I was deciding to get married. Right. And I didn't think I wanted to be in a traveling band and be married, because everybody I knew that got married was in a traveling band soon was not married anymore.
Right, right.
So I figured, well, if I'm going to do this, I probably should give it a better shot than that.
And what year was that about?
64.
Oh, so 64 is kind of when you phase out a bit.
Right. So I thought, I got into the studio world and I was a studio musician for about the next 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I played on all kinds of stuff, from jingles to Steve Lawrence records to folky stuff, you know, the new Christy Minstrels.
Huh.
And then I produced records for ABC for a couple of years. And a couple of the things did reasonably well. I didn't have any hits. And I also had some songs that were, I had one song that was recorded by 13 or 14 acts called Someone to Talk My Troubles To. Hmm. And then Van Ronk and I put together a song that Peter, Paul, and Mary put on their first album. Made more money on that than I did on the right. song that was recorded by 14 artists.
Now every song has 14 writers. I know you're right about that, right?
Like, right, exactly.
Yeah. Nobody's making
and it.
Nine publishers and yeah.
So you know, I felt like, and performing was okay with me, but it was never a huge goal.
Right.
And I, most of the places we traveled to, I really was not interested in going to Omaha.
Right. Yeah.
Or, you know, playing Jackson, Mississippi or Greenville. So
why isn't the Bob Dylan Museum in like Omaha or Nebraska?
In Tulsa.
Tulsa. Well, Tulsa is a musical town. Leon Russell and that whole crew.
Well, the Guthrie Center is there.
Okay.
Makes more sense because he is from Oklahoma.
Okay, sorry.
But somehow they got money from the Kaiser Foundation.
Okay.
And so there's the Dylan Center. And I would imagine there were other places that wanted to have it.
Right.
Because it's a tourist attraction.
Sure. Well, that could use it. I mean,
yeah.
You know, versus up here, I'm sure. I think the woman who bought the Bears Little Complex and the, I think she was she's intending to do something with that second story room above the Cafe Depresso or whatever, that's how they used to call it then, you know, some kind of Dylan museum or something, but I don't believe that's come about yet. But so what do you think about, have you seen him recently? I mean, live, or I mean, what's your take on Dylan these days?
I have not seen him live in 100 years.
Right.
And I'm not really terribly interested in what he's doing, to be honest. You know, okay. I don't, and I think he's well aware of the fact that, why does he continue to tour? I don't know. He must have a different attitude towards performance than I do, for sure.
Well,
you know, he must get some enjoyment out of it.
And he was, you know, in the 60s, whatever, that he took a big chunk of time off after the motorcycle accident.
Right.
I saw
my him, impression I, from people that have seen him
right.
is that the shows are very irregular. Like one night he'll really be on. And another night it's like, why did I just pay $100 for this show?
I know. Well, I saw him once, and I saw him in the 80s, probably 1985. and he was backed by Tom Petty's band. And
yeah.
it was in his heavy mumble phase. I didn't understand a word that came out of the guy's mouth. I mean, it's much better now. It was like really, it was, I wasn't a big Tom Petty fan. You know, I respect him and everything, but it wasn't, it was just an underwhelming, you know, experience. So, you know, you best listen to the old albums and, you know, so have you been, my last question, have you been back to the Village lately? I mean, any time?
No, I have not. I haven't been there probably in 8 or 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, after I did the studio thing, I moved to Colorado in 72 and went to music school.
Oh, wow.
And that's what I did. And I've lived in either Denver or Boulder ever since, except that I lived in Portland, Oregon for about 10 years because I just got tired of living out here. And I felt like whatever there was for me to do here, I had done.
Right. Well,
and
that's a
then,
long stretch.
Yeah. So I came back here about 8 years ago under odd circumstances. My wife was hit by a car.
Oof.
And she had a couple of knee operations, and we got a good settlement. And we found that Portland doesn't have one-story houses.
Oh, really?
It's all two stories or more.
Oh.
She had a bad knee.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the suburbs have – we didn't want to live in the suburbs of Portland, which I don't have anything against them. I don't have anything for them.
Yeah, yeah.
No, no, but they weren't why I would have.
They're the same anywhere, suburbs.
Yes,
I mean, as our strip malls. You know, it's the same.
So,
it's the same deal.
We came back here, and in the interim, I had taught college for 12 years here, and continued to write and record, and I've done 7 or 8 albums of my own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mostly on my own label.
Yeah, why not? That's what you do.
And I've had, you know, some success with TV and film placements. So I've written a lot of books.
Right.
So it's a combination of things that I do. I don't teach anymore.
Right.
But I do all the other stuff.
Great. Well, thanks for your time. And again, I'm going to hold up the book. You won't see it on the radio and in the podcast, but it was nice because I have to tell you, it was very concise, which I appreciated. And after reviewing, I do a lot of book reviews. So I had done the Sonny Rollins biography. It was like 900 pages. I had a couple of 800 page books right ahead of your book. And then again, as I told you, my own connection to A, New York City, B, working in the Village. You know, I worked in the Village, as I think we were discussing in my...
I've got a couple of stories that you...
Go ahead. Sure, we got time.
Okay, here's one of them. I ran into Dylan the year after I moved to Colorado. I was walking across 57th Street. And there's Dylan. And Dylan being Dylan, you know, we were in the direct path. So I figured, I don't know how he's going to react to seeing me. He was very friendly. And he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to music school. And he looked at me very seriously, and he wasn't sarcastic at all. And he said, that sounds like something good to do.
Right.
And later I found out from one of my professors, Dylan's brother went to music school, David, who was not well known. And he went to the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay. And this guy was teaching there. So I think that was the background. So the idea of somebody he knew going to music school wasn't as weird as it might have been otherwise. So here's a story that's really about Grossman, not about Dylan. Artie Traum and I were good friends. And Artie was living And Dylan had two houses in Woodstock for a
Right.
while. So he hadn't sold the first house. And Artie was living in the first house at the invitation of Al
At the
Gross.
one in the Bird Cliff.
Yeah. So it had like 19 rooms. So Artie said, "Why don't you come up and visit me? I got all this space." So I came up. First thing he does, he says, "I want to show you something." And we go in this room. And there's like a dozen sacks of mail, all unopened mail to Bob Dylan. So he looks at me and he says, "Let's open a couple of these letters, see what the hell they are." So we open one, and it's a letter from a young woman from, I think, one of the Dakotas. "Dear Bob, I went to your show in wherever the hell, Fargo, Bismarck, and talks about how great the show was. And she says, you probably don't remember me, but I went there with Rick Danko and, and all of that." And we kind of looked at each other and thought, that's a world that we don't live in. We don't get letters from
No.
women that we saw for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
Then, I remember seeing you at the largest venue in Fargo, and all that stuff. So then later, Albert Grossman calls Artie and he says, "Artie, I've been thinking, you're living in this house and you're not paying any rent at all. You could at least pay the heating bill." So Artie, this is Woodstock, a 20 room house. I
Yeah.
mean, you know what that is in the winter. So
Way of
Artie said,
950 square feet.
"Albert, the heating bill for this house would be four times the rent that I would pay." So Albert basically said, "Okay, I just had a try."
Well,
I
that's the
thought that
man.
was a great portrait of Albert, that side of his personality. And finally, this is something I read. It's not a story of mine. Jerry Scheff is a studio bass player at
Yeah,
Tortle. He
Doors.
was in Dylan's band for a while. A lot of people have been in Dylan's
Played on
band.
the Doors too.
So Jerry was in this band at the end of this particular year's tour. Dylan calls a meeting of the band and he says, "This is the best band I have ever had on tour. Just wanted to thank you guys. It's just been great." About a week later, Jerry gets a call from Dylan and he says, "I've been thinking about using," and he named some drummer, I don't know who it was, but let's say it was Al Rogers or somebody. And he says, "I've been thinking about using Al Rogers on drums." The next day, Jerry gave his notice and he said, "I realized that talk about being the best band didn't mean anything, that, it's all creature of the moment. Whatever the king wants is what the king is going to get." And I thought that was really an interesting insight that, and I admired him for not waiting for the shoe to drop, saying, "This is a good gig, but I don't need you. I can do this for somebody else." So I thought that was interesting. I mean, you compare that, this is sort of off the wall, but Taylor Swift did her last tour, and believe me, I'm not a Taylor Swift fan, if anybody would have guessed that, right? She gave all of her bus drivers 100 grand each to help them buy houses.
Amazing.
Now, I don't have any feelings about Taylor Swift at all. I'm neither astounded at her success, nor does it irritate me, because that's the way the game is played, But I have to say that I think that was a great thing to do,
Oh no, wonderful. I mean, we live in a
and she
time.
didn't have to do that. She could have given $10,000 and they would have been overjoyed. So you compare, say, Dylan and Taylor Swift, who's got the hippie credentials? Not Taylor Swift. So I guess it's one of those you never know, do you?
Yeah.
Routines.
Well, this is great. I enjoy your stories. Maybe you should be doing a bus tour of the village. Get yourself a little bus, you get yourself a microphone. I will not be holding up the audio visual as I did for Danny Fields. It was too much work. But thanks again, and it's a great book. I really enjoy talking to you, and I'm going to dig a little bit more into your musical background, which really I didn't you didn't really present too much of it here, which is kind of interesting, which is kind of noble. It was about Dylan, and I'm sure you have a book in you
Well,
too.
I mean, I realize that the audience for this book
Is not
is not the
yeah.
audience for my music.
Well, my audience will be fascinated. So thank
Yeah,
you,
great.
Dick. And the book is Bob Dylan's New York. And till next
Nobody
time.
thank you,
Feels
Sal.
any pain. Tonight is asking inside the rain. Everybody knows that baby's got new clothes, but lately I see her ribbons and her bows have fallen from her curls. She takes just like a woman. Yes, yeah, she does. She makes love just like a woman. Yes, yeah, she does. And she aches just like a woman. But she breaks just like a little girl. Queen Mary, she's my friend. Yes, I believe I'll go see her again. Nobody has to guess. That baby can't be blessed till she finally sees that she's like all the rest, with her fog, her amphetamine, and her pearls. She takes just like a woman. Yes, she makes love just like a woman. Yes, she does, and she aches just like a woman, but she breaks just like a little girl.